Hello, I am Laurie Egbert, Renegade Laurie. I wanted to do this initial podcast to really talk to you about what drives the passion behind my Renegade programs and why I consider myself to be a Renegade woman. A lot of people, when they hear the word renegade, they think someone who breaks the law or doesn't actually conform to society, an outlaw, so to speak. But renegade really is just someone who betrays a set of principles. And yes, it can be used in a negative context, but in this case, it's really not. A renegade is often someone who's looked at as a deserter from a faith. I'm someone who rejects conventional behavior. And my challenge is, let's not think of being a renegade as a negative thing. If right now in today's society we looked around us, there are a lot of things that we pledge our allegiance to that we really probably shouldn't. Alcoholism, obesity, hate, bigotry. There are a lot of different things in which we wish, a lot of different things in which we should probably break ourselves and our alliances too. So as a renegade woman, I've broken myself away from the sets of principles and opinions in which others have placed on me. I betray the thought that I have to be a certain type of person because I'm a woman or because I'm white. Or because I am not perfect. And so my challenge through the Renegade program is to help everybody else also figure out where it is that they're aligning themselves to. What principles or whose principles are you actually living your life by? And it is time. It is time for us as women, as creators and builders, to really go ahead and set our own set of principles and live by our own alliances to what we know and feel is our own purpose. And, you know, this isn't the first time in history that anybody said, you know, repel the norm or be a renegade. One of my favorite scenarios or examples is the story of Calamity Jane, or Martha Jane Cannery as she was born. Most people don't even know who Calamity Jane is. She is a folk hero. She's from the 1800s, and she was known as a Wild West sharpshooting, whiskey swilling woman who, because she dressed as a man, was a crossdresser also, oddly enough. And we look around us today and we see that our LGBTQAI community continues to be not accepted and have a lot of issues, but that's for another podcast. You know, so in addition to breaking the norms and being a renegade against the principles of the time, she was still kind. She was known for kindness towards others. So being a renegade doesn't mean that we have to not continue to be the good people and do the good things that are inherently who we are. So no, being a renegade isn't a bad thing. We have Dolores Huerta, forgive me if I did not pronounce that correctly, who was an American labor leader and a civil rights activist. And she co-founded what is now known to be the United Farm Workers. And by the way, when she was 89, she continued to work and develop these leaders in advocacy, working for the poor, for women, for children. So, you know, this is something that we should be doing our whole entire lives. It would be my pleasure to take this journey with you if this is where you find yourself, if you are ready to break the chains, so to speak, that bind you to a life and a set of principles that were set for you and not by you. So I look forward to joining you on the journey. If this is a journey you've already actually partaken of, I would love to hear all about it, as well my listeners. So let's just hopefully hear from you and stay tuned. Subscribe to this podcast to hear from more renegade women in today's world.
Hi, Susan. Hi, Lori.
How are you?
Good, you?
I am fantastic. I'm super happy to have you. Just to update anybody who's listening to this podcast, you, in my opinion, fit what I call a renegade woman. And renegade sounds a little extreme, but renegade really is someone who tends to break away from social norms, rules, and, you know, the world puts enough of that on us, that we don't have to live by continuing to take on those rules and expectations of others and social norms, right? We're meant to live our true, authentic selves. And I would love for you to go ahead and share your story with our listeners.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Thanks for having me. I would love to say that this just came to me one day out of nowhere. Hey, I'm gonna give a month's notice at my job/career and do something else. But this change, like most life changes, was brought about by immense pain. My father died about 2 years ago, and it was, as is often the case with most folks, a reality check about really what was the value of my life. Not that I was suicidal, but where was I spending the bulk of my time? What was getting most of my time? And the answer wasn't really my dad or my mom, but it wasn't even really my immediate family, my husband and my children, or even myself. It was my job.
And I'm sure that as soon as anybody heard you say that, everybody's going, oh man, yes, I hate what I do. They're living that Sunday night regret, Monday morning is here, and then the celebratory end of Friday, the weekend's here. And man, our lives are 7 days a week, right? Like, live our lives every single day doing something we love. So talk about where the inspiration to find what you love and what drives you, and how did you find your purpose? Because some people don't even know yet.
Right. I have been a writer my entire life. I wasn't sure when I was a child if I was a writer or an artist. I went back and forth. And ultimately, in undergrad, I chose writing. And my college, I was very fortunate, offered a minor in creative writing. And in my creative writing classes in college, I guess, found my people, as the saying goes. And I was inspired to continue writing throughout my 20s and 30s more seriously again, and still to this day.
Do you have anything specific that you're currently working on that's driving you?
I have been spending the bulk of this year on my memoirs. I am the ripe old age of 46, which I feel is quite the label of middle age. So I am capturing the saga, or the best of my first half of my life.
That sounds exciting. I can't wait to read it.
Oh, thank you.
I can't. That's going to be fantastic. Well, thanks. Already the parts that I have seen have been riddled with blessings, love. From the outside, we always look in and we think how wonderful things look and how easy it seemed that transition for you was from this career that was draining you to where you are today. Is it really that easy?
It is not. Even as you and I were speaking before we turned the mic on, you know, trying to adjust to, you know, I spent a good 20 years in another career, including the final training years. And to adjust now in 2019 to a world where, you know, tech has turned the job market as I knew it 20 years ago on its head, to, you know, the latest apps and technologies and, you know, things like blogging and how to market my writing and, you know, how to really pursue the dream of becoming a full-time writer is very challenging, but it's also very exciting.
So talk about the kind of support that one might need in order to make a transition to driving their passion and their authentic selves.
Well, I kind of had a moment of panic before you turned the mic on and said record, because I do not see tissues readily available, although I have some in my backpack right here.
Okay.
The support from my husband has been unbelievable, because I could not do this. I could not have left that career without a stable partner. And I'm sure that it has to be what holds people back sometimes from making such drastic life changes or career changes. And I'm just really grateful to him for kind of helping us financially hold it together, you know, agreeing and, you know, working through together in our daily communications, you know, to say, hey, we're going to liquidate that savings. Okay. You know, and it's a conversation that we have for days or weeks or months, and then we finally, you know, that one's gone. Okay, what about the next account? And just having faith and belief in some of the, you know, hey, okay, I'm going to try this part-time job for a while, or I'm going to temp here for a while. Just allowing me the freedom to make money, bring some money into the family, feels good. But it's not what I used to make, you know, I won't lie. Mm-hmm. And to have that faith and spirituality, my spirituality is really what has sustained me and sustained my family and I.
Who are you now that you're living your authentic self? What's the difference between Susan today and her authenticity and her growing development as opposed to Susan who is still living in this dark place where she was unhappy?
Again, that's pretty heady. Mm-hmm. I realized lately that I did not know my children. You know, I was working 6 days a week and I just didn't spend a lot of time with them. And I mean, I got them maternity leave and they're each born. They are now 5 and 9. And of course, like all children, they're incredibly forgiving and do not say, hey, mom, when, you know, when you were a teacher, boy, you couldn't, you know, da, da, da. But I realized that. And I realized that when I made the decision to quit my career and to give that month's notice, I thought it was to be there for my mother or maybe for myself. But what I'm really finding is that it brought me closer. It's brought me back to my family and shown me what it's like to be a mother.
That's so powerful. I can actually identify with that. I waited too long, you know, and being able to see people have that bravery makes you realize that, you know what? Yeah, I might have waited until my kid was old enough to be able to tell me, Ma, you fucked up. But you know what? The people in our lives, no matter at what stage, whether it's your husband, my child, someone's, you know, partner, extended family, they see that it's never too late.
Hmm.
You know, you mentioned middle age. I just turned 46 this past week.
Oh, welcome to 46.
Yes, yes. So I do. I look back and I sometimes say to myself, who am I?
Hmm.
You know, and am I too old or is it too late? And it's absolutely not never too late.
Hmm.
And you're never too old.
Hmm.
So that is really powerful. You're blessed, as you had said, to have a supportive familial unit where you have a husband that was able to, with you, make the decision to help you be your authentic self. There are people out there who I imagine are single parents. They may not have others to lean on.
Mm.
Do you have any kind of advice on perhaps just where to even start with themselves to gain the momentum to begin to even look into what it would take?
I would just suggest real basic things. The first thing I think of is like self-care type things, because obviously everyone can't quit their job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any, you know, easy ways for folks to get the thousands of dollars we need a month to sustain ourselves in today's world. I guess I would just say self-care basics for me are like getting up early to get prayer and meditation time for myself. Self-care, drinking, staying hydrated, eating well, saying no to people's invitations sometimes. Friday night, just coming home and crashing instead of maybe staying out late and doing the Friday night party or go out with friends thing. Exercise, just some real basics. And maybe if you don't have a savings account, I still have a savings account through this whole thing. And it has dropped dramatically from what I used to put in it. And I haven't put anything in my retirement for 2 years. And that's scary. But mm-hmm. I because of my spiritual path and my great faith in the universe, I know not to panic. It will come back. And right now I think I'm putting like $5 or $10 every couple weeks into my savings. That's it. But I am saving. I am putting something in there to have. And I won't lie, you know, we don't live on a budget, but we have an ongoing budget proposal and we are extremely aware of where all money is going at all times. Mm-hmm. And we're accruing a little debt, like I said, and that's new for me. But from what I understand, it's not really that big a deal. And people do work their way through debt sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess really my suggestion would be obviously the cliche, like hold on to your dream, maybe see what little, like I know my good friend and I always says take baby steps. Like what little things can you do to start? There's a lot of great literature out there in the self-care or self-help section of books, like on Amazon or in old-fashioned bookstores. Mm-hmm. Find something that speaks to you. I know I find little writer's books lately, being a writer, and they're just real short. You know what? And I don't read the entire book at lunch. I just read like 5 pages because that's all I have time for. And then I have to get back, to my part-time job or get back to my writing stuff. Think small. Don't think big. Think small. Just mm-hmm. get started.
Thank you. I'm really glad that you actually said self-care, because so often I think people, when they heard me ask you that question, they were getting ready with their pen and a paper.
Mm.
They were like, what actionable physical things can I do?
What magic solution does she have?
Yep.
Yes.
And you know, it's so funny because as I've been on this journey, everywhere I turn, there are people who are physically moving in a direction, and they're so out of touch with their selves because they don't sit and they're not present and they don't know how to be, that 5 years later, I've seen people just take a complete 180 and realize that they were on the wrong path, because they all of a sudden started a self-care routine and they started getting to know who they were.
Mm.
And then truly were able to take those little steps. Yeah, huge little steps. I love that idea.
Yeah, one of my friends who has a lot of words of wisdom, one of my favorite sayings in the last several years has been, don't just do something, sit there.
Mm.
You know, we always think we have to go, go, go. And I feel like, especially in my former career, and even today, you know, I come across people every day, go, 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 go. And I start going too fast sometimes. And what happens? I run into something, or I drop something, or whatever. And just about, no, things really aren't life and death.
Yep.
You know, we think they are. You know, every year our pace is faster and faster. But you can just stop and do nothing sometimes. That's really okay.
It's powerful, too.
Mm-hmm.
It is. Oh, thank you so much. Is there anything last minute that you want to throw out there about anything that you're passionate about to drive and inspire other women?
Well, I mean, like I said in the beginning, grief inspired me. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I just got to give a shout out to grief, which I know sounds crazy. But man, if you've got some losses going on, if you've got stuff, try to honor it the best you can. It takes a long time to go through that stuff. And society doesn't respect that at all. I know when my dad died, you know, it was like, here's a couple days of leave, which my current job, I wouldn't even get that. So it was still something, but honor your losses, you know, honor the changes you're thinking of doing, because change is going to be a loss of something else. Process it how you can best process it, because everyone's way of dealing with it is going to be different. I know that's definitely something I've had to wade through, look at, and think about how, you know, my connections between my personal life mirror my professional. What are they, if any, and what aren't?
Yep.
And that's sorting.
I do.
Yeah.
That's really big. I'm so glad that you agreed to talk to us.
Oh, thank you.
I can't wait as people start, listening, and you always hear feedback and how excited that they were to be able to hear how you touched them. And I want to encourage everybody to keep checking back on the podcast and wherever else this might get posted. Because as soon as Susan's memoir is ready to go, I will...
Or my blog.
Or the blog. Anything that Susan's sharing will be updated and shared as well, so you can keep up with her as well. So thank you so much, Susan.
You're welcome.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you so much for your willingness to talk with my listeners. My listeners come here because the stories that you share, people like you share, are intended to help them get through whatever it is that they're going through in life. And even if it's a similar situation or a different situation, I think that as women, we need to really just start connecting as a society again and lifting each other up and being supportive. And so this is sort of just one of those things that I'm doing on the world of the internet to be more of a positive voice and bring other positive voices that I've told you over and over again that I admire the heck out of you.
Thank you.
over the years, just watching everything that you go through, and you do it with grace and this humility that I would love for you to just pour out for all of us and tell us your journey. Tell us where you started and where does your journey start?
Yeah, it started in an unhappy marriage, and not just unhappy with my marriage, I really unhappy with me. Didn't like myself, was very overweight. I really didn't have a good thing to think or say about myself. Didn't know what I wanted. If somebody asked me what I wanted, I could tell you what the rest of my family wanted. I could tell you what my ex-husband wanted, but I didn't know what I wanted. Now you can ask me what I want, and it might take me, sometimes it might take me a couple days, but I can get down to what I want.
That there's so much realness to that. I think that society, it starts with when we're little, right? We're women, we're these little girls, and in our generations, we were still put in pink ribbons with lace, and we're told to be pretty and not talk back. And, right? So and I know that a lot of the younger, maybe more millennial generations listening to this might not necessarily relate to that. But we know that in their world, there are things that they're being imposed upon with in their lives. Like school, for example. I follow this one gentleman, Gary V. He's a little vulgar for me. I'll tag him as well in the description here if anybody ever wants to go back and listen to some of his stuff. But he speaks to a lot of the millennials, and for them, it's their parents want them to go to school. Their parents say that you have to do this.
Yes.
And no, with technology and things the way they are today, they might not need to. But anyway, I digress. Mm-hmm. So how early did it start for you? Did it start in school? Did it start in your youth? Like, where did that I need to be, I need to serve others' needs versus my own start?
It probably started in my family of origin. Very young. But I never learned it. You know, I never learned how to speak up for myself. I think it started when I was really young, but moved on to, you know, the school bullies and the being a little chubby in school, and that was different, and so I felt bad about that, and just feeling like I had to look a certain way and act a certain way to be liked and to be accepted.
That's a struggle today still, I'm sure, no matter what generation you're in.
You know, I feel like that's one of the things that I've come a long, long way with. Yes, I think it's always going to be a little bit of a struggle. I think it's always going to come into my head that I should look or act a certain way. But I think I also have a lot more self-confidence, and I enjoy being myself. And when I'm relaxed and just being who I am instead of trying to be who I think you want me to be, I find that it puts the other person at ease as well.
So Sharon, you were talking about you were never really taught, perhaps, let's call it self-love, right? You obviously have that now. What can they do to start the process of self-love?
Well, first I have to give you a little bit of background, because this is a great story. I went to this therapist who told me I didn't love myself, and I thought I had always been working on self-love all my life. And I was really angry with her. But I went back the next week because I knew she was right. And she was surprised to see me.
Wow.
She said, "I didn't think you were coming back." So I think it started there. I think it starts with finding out the truth, with seeing the truth that I didn't love myself. I thought I did loving things for myself. I looked good on the outside, but I wasn't really taking care of my inside world. And that really speaks to my whole life. You know, I always looked good on the outside. People thought I had it all together, and I didn't. I really didn't. I was a mess inside. And so I think my journey included therapy, it included 12-step programs, it included whatever I could use to get healthy and quiet with myself. It was a spiritual process, a very spiritual process for me. Writing, I write poetry and I enjoy writing, and sometimes I don't know what's going on inside me, but if I put it down on paper, it comes around to, I get my answers really through writing a lot of the time. There were things that I did, like starting to eat better, getting more rest, doing loving things for myself. But part of those loving things for myself were things that one doesn't normally think of when they think of this is a loving thing for myself. And that was the harder things to do. That was setting boundaries, speaking my truth, sharing who I was on the inside with people. All scary, scary things. But each time I did these things, I got happier. I don't know. I just felt better about myself. And I was accepted. I always thought I wasn't going to be accepted if I'm not this way or that way. I have to be loving and kind. But you know what? I am. So, you know, it's not just what's in my head of about not speaking up. And it's okay to have a differing opinion from somebody else. I wasn't really allowed to have that in my home as a child, and I wasn't allowed to have that in my marriage. It's almost kind of fun now to speak up with a difference of opinion.
You know, that is so funny that you say that, because it seems a very different perspective, because I can remember in my own journey, there was a time it was terrifying. I would cry, maybe even days in angst over, I have to speak my truth, but I was so terrified that I would be rejected for that truth. What can people do? You mentioned writing already, and that it was a spiritual process for you. You'd mentioned therapy. What other resources or books or groups would you recommend someone start with? If they're in that I'm miserable phase and I need to change my life, like, what would be the first thing that they could do?
Oh, there's this great book and I can't think of the name of it.
When you do, we'll post it in the description, okay, in the comments, so that they can look for that.
Great.
So that book did what for you?
It takes you through how to be compassionate with yourself. That was part of my journey too, was going through the grief when when my marriage broke up, and having the compassion for myself as I was going through that grief. That, you know, allowing myself to take the time I needed to grieve and have my feelings, and also like putting comfy slippers on, wrapping up in a blankie, you know, maybe watching some kind of animated movie on Netflix, and just things that I could do for myself that were loving and compassionate, instead of, oh, you shouldn't be having these feelings, because that's how I spent my life. You know, not having any feelings. It's really why I gained as much weight as I did, because I ate over that stuff and stuffed down my feelings.
So many of us do that. So what's the difference between, in your opinion, and this might be different for everybody, but for you, what was the difference between avoiding and isolating in front of an animated movie or under a blanket, as opposed to self-care? What is the difference? What are the colored glasses you put on that changes what that looks like?
Okay, so I'm making it sound really easy, but it was not an easy process for me. It took me doing this over and over again, and dealing with the guilt of I should be doing the dishes, or I should be cleaning, or I shouldn't waste my time doing this. I had to continue a lot of self-talk and push away the guilt feelings. No, you know, if the guilt came up, oh, you should be doing this, I'd go, no, right now I'm doing self-care. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm sitting on the couch with my blanket and I need it. It was just a lot of self-talk, a lot of positive, you know, a lot of taking the negative self-talk and turning it into positive self-talk.
I'm so glad that you were talked about the self-talk, because one of my favorite sayings is change your mind, change your life. You know, it always starts what's up here, what's in my head, because it's what you think every single day that drives what you do and what you feel. But I also know from personal experience myself that if you're listening to this and you're beginning to realize you're unhappy, don't talk to yourself by yourself, because there are so many of us who in this world go through, I went through my 20s before I was diagnosed with depression and anxiety. So I kept myself in this perpetual loop. I want to encourage anybody who's listening and identifying with the unhappiness or stuck feelings that they get help, that they find a therapist, that they find a 12-step group. You know, there are so many varieties out there, you know, not to really pinpoint any one of them, but if you're listening to this and you need a support group, there's hospice if you're losing a loved one, there's Alcoholics Anonymous if you're an alcoholic, there's Narcotics, there's Al-Anon, there are so many different things. Talk to your hospital, talk to your doctor, talk to a therapist. And if you're just not ready yet to leave your home, I know I had to start with resources that I could read and I could digest. So for me, my stepmom was the one who had the resources and had done the self-work herself, and was reading things like A Course in Miracles. And for me, I tried, it was worse than reading the Bible. I couldn't understand a word. For me, it was the Marianne Williamson. It was A Woman's Worth. And that was what started to teach me what my worth actually could look like. So yes. I know you'd mentioned earlier there was a book. So do you have like,
Oh, you do remember that one?
Yes, oh,
all right, Self-Compassion by, I think her name was Kristen Neff. Mm-hmm. And it was Brené Brown.
That's awesome.
One of the writers, too. Yeah.
Good. So if you're listening to this, check out those resources. I will put everything we're talking about in the video description. If you're listening to this in the podcast, feel free to also look online. There will be a link. And you'll be able to pull these wonderful resources that has helped my wonderful friend Sharon grow into the amazing, strong, and self-loving woman that she is today. Thanks for chatting.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. So welcome, Taylor. I'm so glad to have you.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Renegade Women is a program that I started because myself and other women tend to find ourselves in this society locked into a stereotype, an expectation, or sometimes we're just having struggles that are unique to women. And this specific episode really is an advocacy episode. And Taylor, I'm going to let you go ahead and introduce yourself and then let us know what you're going to talk about today.
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Taylor McCullough Fries. I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm 24 years old and a registered nurse, and I suffer from endometriosis. So today I'm here to talk about what endo is, what my chronic pain journey has been like, and how we can all advocate to help each other as women.
Now, some people sometimes say, well, renegade, that kind of sounds like the lawbreaker type of connotation. And really, the way that I use renegade in this specific show is that we're women who just don't sit back and just suffer, in your case, for example, right? We fight. And so tell us where your journey started and what started your fight with endometriosis.
Yeah, so when I was 11 years old, I got my first period, which, oh boy, exciting times, right? You're in middle school, it's a big change, there's all these hormones. But for me, on top of just going through puberty, I started having severe pain. And it kind of presented itself in an odd way. So initially, the doctors all thought, like many times, that I had appendicitis because I was having pain in my abdomen, more so on the right-handed side. I was fatigued. I was stressed out beyond belief. My periods were awful. They lasted a lot longer than they should. There were times where I bled for months on end. They were heavy. They were irregular. Just nothing sort of seemed to go according to plan, if you will. So started with my pediatrician. You know, they're worried, oh, it's appendicitis. So many ER visits and diagnostic testing later, appendix was fine. They couldn't figure out what was wrong. So from there, it kind of evolved into this game of what's the diagnosis? And that's unfortunately common for women with endo. On average, it takes 10 years for an accurate diagnosis. So unfortunately, the only way to be diagnosed with endometriosis accurately is with an exploratory laparoscopy, which is a surgery performed by a surgical gynecologist. And they have to physically go into the pelvis, find lesions of endometriosis, and then have them biopsied for confirmation. So for me, all of this started at 11. I wasn't accurately diagnosed until I was 16. And I would say, give or take, there were probably about 10 different doctors within that time frame that were trying to figure out what was wrong. And unfortunately, with endo, on average, it takes 10 years for correct diagnosis. So that's 10 years that this disease has to grow and flourish in your body and just get worse. For me, luckily, it was a shorter amount of time. It was about 5 years, but that can't be said for every woman. So,
I was actually just going to say 5 years is the majority of your middle school and then most of the formative high school years. How does endometriosis undiagnosed, what are the stigmas that you had to deal with as a child in school, you know, in pain all the time?
Yeah. So in all honesty, it was pretty traumatic. I missed a lot of school, which in and of itself is hard. I was a straight A student all throughout school. So no matter what, I was pretty good about making up my work. But that being said, you have a girl who's incapacitated by pain most days. My work was being sent to me pretty erratically. So some days the teachers were good about sending it home. Other days they weren't. When I was actually in school, one of the things is, you know, I was bleeding so much, I had to use the bathroom more often than other students. And a commonality that I found is a lot of teachers get very upset when students repeatedly ask to use the restroom because there's just the stigma that they're not paying attention in class and they're just trying to get out of it. So I would have to have doctor's notes written to the teachers to allow me to even use the restroom. Mm. Relationships with friends suffered. I mean, again, we're all going through puberty. There's a ton of hormonal changes. Cliques are forming. And it was really hard for them to understand. For people that don't live with pain every day, I think it is a hard concept to wrap your brain around. So there was some bullying, which wasn't ideal. And eventually my sophomore year of high school, I transferred to cyber school just so that I was better able to control my work. I was at home. If I was in pain, I could get to doctor's appointments more easily without missing out on classwork. And in the end, it actually worked out because I got a semester of college under my belt going to cyber school. So I started college when I was 16 years old.
Wow. Hence the RN at 24. When it comes to pain, right now, as an example, I am walking around with a boot and a shoe, which is visible to most people, so that if I'm in a grocery store and I grab a cart, they're like, oh, she's, you know, broken foot. I imagine not only with the challenges that you've just walked us through as a child with endometriosis, that there had to have been a lot of judgment as well that you've dealt with that, you know, because you look okay.
Yeah, exactly. And so us in the endometriosis, and I would say chronic illness community as a whole, we're a part of what we call the invisible illness group. So on the outside, I look fine. You know, you can't physically see any deformity, but on the inside, my body is attacking itself and it's incredibly painful. I think for me, I've always been a very stubborn, outspoken kind of girl. I love life. I'm passionate. And so for me, that was super difficult because I wasn't being believed by doctors, friends, teachers, even some family members. And, you know, during those formative years, it takes its toll, but it happens even now. And that's just something that I've really worked on, especially this past year, where you have to know yourself and know your worth. I know what I've been through. I know what the pain feels like. It's amazing when people are empathetic and they try to understand, but not everybody has the capacity to be that way. And those are just the people that I don't really want in my life.
I actually do understand from the mental illness side where you look like you're okay. What's wrong with you? When it comes to endometriosis, you talked a little bit about some of the doctor visits and the diagnostic process. What treatment is there out there for others with endo?
Right. So the most effective form of treatment for endometriosis, and let me preface this by saying there is no cure. There's always a chance that it's going to come back. You need to really work with your doctors as an ongoing process. The best thing that's evidence-based practice is excision surgery. So again, it's a laparoscopy, but they go in, and if you imagine endometriosis as a weed, excision surgery is cutting that weed out by the root. There's also ablation surgery, which is burning the flower off of the weed. So it's very superficial. You think that you got it, but you didn't. And unfortunately, I went through 8 ablation surgeries before realizing that excision was the way I needed to go. And that being said, even with excision, it can still come back. So I actually had 2 excision surgeries. My last was in February of 2018. And I traveled to Atlanta, Georgia for it, to the Center for Endometriosis Care. Unfortunately, the doctors here in Pittsburgh got to the point where they essentially said that because they performed surgery on me, there was no way I could still be in pain, no way I still had endo. It was all in my head. I was anxious, stressed, you know, the typical you're a hysterical woman type of comments. So traveled to Atlanta. Lo and behold, I had endo everywhere. And they also found that I had adenomyosis, which in the most simplistic layman's terms is endometriosis within the uterus. So unfortunately, there's no way to excise that. It's embedded in the uterus. It's something that is always going to be there. My uterus was thick enough that I had to have a hysterectomy. So in August of 2018, 23 years old, I had a complete hysterectomy, and they also removed my right ovary because it kept twisting and there was still endometriosis on it. So that, I think for me, was a really pivotal moment in my endo journey.
So when you have to get to the point of a hysterectomy, I'll be honest with you, I mean, is everything literally gone? Because when you said they took just my one ovary, in my mind I'm going, oh, wait a minute, I thought hysterectomy, I thought you took everything. Right. So what exactly did the hysterectomy help? How did it help you? And I know you said there's no cure, but what are the chances of the reoccurrence after having to go so far as a hysterectomy?
Right. So hysterectomy is not a cure for endometriosis. It is a cure for adenomyosis because you're removing the sick organ. So for me, that meant no more heavy periods that lasted for 6 months at a time, no more crippling pain because of my periods. So at that point, you know, my uterus was sick enough that my doctor and I made the decision that it would give me the best quality of life. However, I do still have my left ovary, so I'm not in menopause. It's always a concern and something that has to be monitored. But that being said, you know, my fertility has been extremely affected by endo, adeno, all of the surgeries. And I think for me, that's been the most difficult part. So reoccurrence of endo, studies say that if you have a proper excision surgery, and this is nothing to do with hysterectomy, that there's a chance that it could come back in 7 years. Some women have excision and they never need to have surgery again. Some women have excision and they have to have it sooner than that. It's very body dependent and disease dependent. For me, fertility preservation has always been a huge goal and something that I made very clear to my doctors. Unfortunately, again, the teams here in Pittsburgh didn't really heed my concerns, and they just kept saying, you know, you're young, your egg quality will be fine, even with one ovary, don't worry about it. So last year I went to pursue egg freezing, and I don't have that many eggs. So it would be causing more harm to myself to attempt that process than, I don't want to say is worth it, but risk versus benefit, it's a slippery slope.
What would be your advice to anyone who is watching this and is wondering if, wow, I wonder if endo, adeno, I wonder if there's even something else? What are the first things that women can do, young women even too? Let's say they are in their teens. Who do they go to? Parents, of course, I you know, to start, but what resources are there?
So for me, I found my resources kind of later on in my journey. There's wonderful organizations. One of the biggest, and two of the co-founders have actually become friends now, is the Endo Coalition. And it's a nonprofit organization that focuses on educating the public about endometriosis and about excision surgery. Because unfortunately, most regular gynecologists aren't equipped to properly deal with endo. My story and so many other women's has been one of having a lot of hormonal treatments pushed at us, lots of different kinds of birth control, some types of chemotherapeutic agents that suppress ovarian function. And unfortunately, you know, while that may rid you of pain for a little while. There are a lot of side effects that aren't mentioned, just due to issues with big pharma and proper studies. So the Endo Coalition's goal is really just proper education and helping people find excision specialists and great doctors. Another amazing resource on Facebook is Nancy's Nook. So Nancy Peterson is an RN who suffered with endometriosis her whole life. And she created this group on Facebook where women can go. There's a whole library of research articles. You could type in, for example, oh, I'm having lower right-sided pain. And it'll pop up with articles and comments from other women who have experienced the same thing, as well as a directory of physicians listed by country and state who are excision specialists. And they've been vetted by Nancy that they are excision specialists. They're not going to push the chemotherapeutic agents unless, you know, absolutely necessary. And that was a huge resource for me in finding a doctor who could properly treat me, not only surgically, but with respect and understanding my disease and the toll it takes physically, mentally, spiritually. So those are two amazing resources, as well as Dr. Sally Serrell. She is a physical therapist. She specializes in pelvic pain. And she and other leaders in the industry are going to be hosting an endometriosis summit in 2020. So it's going to be a big conference where patients, doctors, caregivers, everybody can congregate. There's going to be a lot of speakers. We can tell our stories and get the word out that this is a disease that is under research. And our population needs help. They were huge, huge parts of my journey.
That's fantastic. You did give me all of the links to these resources to any of you who are watching this and you need those resources. Simply go ahead and look into the description and you'll be able to access them directly. As a woman, a professional now, living with a chronic illness, do you still have those problems with employment? And can you share with us a little bit of the resources that might be out there to protect women who are early in their journey, but also want to preserve their lifestyle?
Sure, absolutely. So again, the biggest thing is early diagnosis, early treatment. The sooner you catch the disease, the less surgery you have, the less side effects and comorbidities, so other diseases that go hand in hand with endo, arise. For me, unfortunately, because I got diagnosed later, had some bad experiences with surgery, I'm still dealing with daily chronic pain. As I said, I'm an RN. I got a job right out of college. I was working at the Children's Hospital in the NICU and the cardiac ICU. My dream jobs, I loved it. But last winter, it got to a point where my pain was pretty severe again. And there were times at work where I passed out from pain. I had to leave early, or I had to call off, and that's a horrible feeling. You don't want to leave your fellow nurses hanging. I wanted to be there for my patients, but I just physically couldn't. And unfortunately, the corporation that I was with at the time, they didn't feel that my disease warranted further assistance. So I made the decision to resign. So that, again, I wasn't leaving anybody hanging, and I wasn't putting myself through the heartbreak of people not listening to me again and not believing me. So as of right now, I'm unemployed. Not a fun feeling, especially for someone like me who is so passionate about their job and being active. But that being said, I'm pursuing further treatments. I'm doing everything I can to heal myself and get to a point where I can go back to work at a company that's maybe a little bit more understanding. My best advice is, you know yourself, you know your pain. If work isn't supportive of that, and obviously this isn't an option for anybody because of financial reasons, but if you feel like you're not being supported, don't stay in that environment. You will find somewhere where you are supportive, and you need to do what's best for you and your health. Because if we don't have our health, we don't have anything.
And that sounds extremely unfortunate. And I'm sorry, because I know how important living your purpose and your passion is. So are there other options like disability, FMLH, long-term? Like what else can someone do?
Yeah, there absolutely are. So a lot of companies provide FMLA, so that's family medical leave. Unfortunately, you know, in my situation, I had exhausted that with my surgery, and with every company, it's different, but look into it. See what your company's policies are for medical leave, short-term disability, and long-term disability. Your HR representative should be able to help you with that. And if it comes to the point where you're unable to work, disability is always an option. That's where I'm at. I haven't been approved or denied yet. It's a very long process, I won't lie to you. But if you have the support of your physicians and kind of, you know, in my case, I have over a decade's worth of records kind of backing up all of my symptoms and everything, I think it's worth it to fight for and not to be ashamed of it, because sometimes we need help and it's not a forever thing. You know, my goal, and I know the goal of most of my friends with endo, is to get to a place where we have more good pain days than bad pain days, and we can get back out into the workforce. But definitely, you know, talk to your HR representatives. Look into disability. There's so many resources and so many people out there that are willing to help. You'll find what's best for you.
Thank you so much. And I'm so glad that you are a renegade fighter, because we need more women who are willing to tell their story like you are, so that those who are coming behind us, they don't have to fight so hard, and that maybe they can be heard too.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for your bravery. Again, everybody, Taylor did provide the resources. Please, please take a look down there below. Do your research and talk to your physicians.
Absolutely.
Have a fantastic and blessed day, everybody.
Fantastic women together. You are my opening renegade woman, so thank
wow.
you. I know. So thank you so much for being.
Thank you.
My pleasure. You have inspired me so much over the years that I have known you. And this whole renegade woman thing wouldn't even have come to mind if it weren't that I crossed paths with women like you who inspired me to do what I needed to do for my path. So some people might think, what do you call me a renegade for, right? I'm not breaking any rules here. Well, a renegade woman in my view, and the purpose of this podcast, is someone who has broken away from social norms, expectations, maybe rules by others that were placed on them that made them miserable. They didn't necessarily have to be wrong socially, right? They didn't have to break some law. If you're unhappy, do you continue to be unhappy to meet the expectations of others? And of course, our answer is what?
Fuck no. Sorry.
It's okay. This is
fuck
not.
No.
Fuck no. Why don't you share your journey and where you started and what makes you, in my opinion, a renegade woman?
I am Dr. Yoga Mom. I'm Kimberlyn Cahill. I am a mom of three, and next month I will be celebrating 20 years of being married to my husband and awesomest life partner. Who am I? I'm a yoga teacher. I create and hold space for others to find their own path of transformation so that they can be, whether it's a renegade or their best selves. That's what I do. That's who I am.
Did you always want to do this?
What I thought I was going to be when I grow up was a university president, because I've always been drawn to the work of transformation, to supporting people in being good contributors to the community, to be active participants in authentic community. Mm-hmm. So yes and no.
How is it different then?
It's less cerebral.
Teacher.
And more compassion. Mm. It's more lived experience than strictly an academic perspective. I studied it, but since what was really the impetus or the shift in how I show up was I had a traumatic bicycle accident that nearly took my life. And as a result of that accident, now, some might say that it was the traumatic brain injury that made it possible. I tend to think it was just that it forced me to slow down, gave me some space in my day-to-day activities, which allowed me to contemplate and reflect on who I was in the world and what I really wanted to do. Mm. But it didn't happen in isolation. I actually was broke because I hadn't worked for over a year. My kids were little, and a friend of mine invited me to try yoga. Mm. And in that space, I had my first real experience with being enough. Broken as I was, unable to do even the simplest of postures. When I found yoga, that was where I began. And yet, I had such a powerful experience. At the time, I didn't have the language for it, probably because my brain was still so foggy. But I realized that that was the first time I felt like I wasn't a disappointment. Hmm. That I was okay in my brokenness. In fact, I was still worthy in my brokenness. I didn't know if I was actually going to ever heal. Recover, let alone resume what had been a very physically and intellectually rich life.
So it sounds like you had a rich life, you just said yourself. Mm-hmm. Yet you talk about finding an environment that was welcoming and loving and accepting of you where you were. Mm-hmm. Was there a reason why you didn't feel that way elsewhere in your life?
I think the primary difference was that I was very skilled at helping others and defined my value based on what I could contribute. Sure, I'd had struggles and I'd you know, had life. I mean, mm-hmm. I was a teenager. Teenager, mm-hmm. for anyone, it's hard. But this was the real crux of a shift where I was completely incapacitated. I couldn't live. So to be in such a place of dependency and recognize that my connection to the community was not based on what I could give. It was based on showing up. And so now some of my favorite hashtags are hashtag just show up or mm-hmm. begin again, breathe, move, rest. That these are the mantras, these are the affirmations that come to mind when I hit an obstacle or a roadblock or get a little inspiration to do my day.
Who inspires you?
My children. I find inspiration everywhere. But I gotta say as well that I see inspiration more in people showing up than people performing or people trying to be a leader. So who inspires me?
Yes.
So what inspires me is not so much the person who is in a position of power, but what inspires me is a person who is in self-empowerment. And that's a very different thing. It's often defined as rallying the troops to follow me versus I'm going to do me and the tribe who shows up. It's not a cause and effect as much as it is an action and a reaction. So what inspires me is people showing up. And I have now practiced the skills, which inherently is paying attention to see it all over the place. Yeah, so I read, I watch and listen to podcasts, I seek dialogue and conversation, and that's where inspiration lives for me. That's where vitality is.
So you can imagine the people that I'm trying to reach, you know, the people who maybe have never even learned how to show up. What is step one to showing up? Because it seems easy to you and I. You just get up and you go, right? There's so much more behind that.
Yeah.
So where is it that someone who's sitting here in tears saying to themselves, my God, I wish I could show up like they're talking about? What would be that one?
Well, let me say this then, because how I live, how I show up is based on a philosophy that I call transparent alignment. And transparent alignment is really embracing the idea that if I show up in just my body, meaning here, I might check off the to-do list of being present and accounted for, but that's very different than showing up with attention to both give and receive action or contribution. That's what I'm looking for. When I say living in transparent alignment, the alignment means that I'm living according to what I say I'm living, so there's that congruency. The transparency means that you see it, that you know who I am. And this becomes both a way of attracting my tribe, but more importantly, attracting those people who can help me stay in alignment. Because if I start to wander, they're the first one to say, huh, what does that look like? Transparent alignment is based on three practices, and that is cultivating a clear passion and purpose. I call it your intention. And when you get clear, when you get in touch with your intention, that becomes the foundation for which you decide what you say yes to and what you say no to. Because I know a lot of what stifled me was that I was saying yes to things that people wanted me to do, the expectations, and some of them were aligned with my skill set, but not aligned with my passion.
Yeah.
Not with what made me feel like my contribution was worthy. Hence, I thought it was about what I did, not about who I was.
That's so powerful. Say that one more time.
What I thought was that my value was entirely based on the contribution that I made, and oftentimes a tangible byproduct of my labor. Whereas what I understand now is that the most important gift, the most valuable gift I can give to anyone, Lori, is my attention, which is the second component of transparent alignment in practice. Intention. Then we cultivate our discipline to apply our attention. This is an energy. This is a focus, which, as we know from positive psychology, when we first learn skills, it takes a lot of focus.
Right.
But as we get more comfortable with that skill, it requires less focus, and we can actually experience this euphoria, this flow, this high. So from that intention, we cultivate attention, both of which are skills. Now, it's not linear, okay?
Right.
So in the sense that when I have an intention, then I flush that out to see what's paying attention or what's maybe, here's where I find a lot of success, is finding out what's distracting me. Where is my attention leaking? Like if I had a hole in my pocket and I was sticking my paycheck in there, by the time I got to the bank, it had all leaked out.
Absolutely.
I would sew that hole up that minute, right? Even if it was 2 weeks and go.
And so many of us are oblivious to the holes in which the core of who we are and what we can actually give to ourselves first.
Because attention is energy.
It's gone.
And energy, we don't create it. We can't plug in, right? So energy is the universe's. And however you want to frame your understanding of worldview, that's not to say that it doesn't align with what is my cultural, spiritual, religious background. So the universal existence of energy is beyond me. However, I'm a steward of that energy, right? So as that energy comes in, breath, food, interaction, financial paycheck, as that energy comes in, it's my stewardship on how to invest that in step three, intention, attention, energy, into action. And action includes both the actions of what I do and the non-doing. Or sometimes the undoing.
Yeah, I was actually getting ready to go there. So very well led. I'm not so far removed from the time of intention and attention being quite foreign and messy for me, you know? I had always thought, you know, I'm just not good enough. I'm not ready. I have nothing people want to hear. What are the number of things that someone can do to start intention, attend, like the whole progression, when they're still sitting in a place where they don't feel they have something?
The best strategy they could do is hire someone to be their coach. You gotta find someone who aligns with you, who can speak a language that you understand, right? So yeah, I am a coach, but I didn't set out to be a coach. It was actually almost more of a burden when I woke up to realize I have this unique, this is the Ikigai. Okay, so the Ikigai is a Japanese philosophy of how we define our life's work. What creates that? And it's a balance of, or the Venn diagram, of what we love, what we're good at, what the world needs, and what the way I was introduced to it is what the world can afford to pay me. Now, I have converted that into what's the energy exchange? How is it valuable for the energy that I put in and the energy that I get back, right? So it may not always be an economic transaction, but when I find where those four lists overlap, so that's a homework assignment that anyone can do before they select a coach, right?
Absolutely.
Is write a list of, what do I love? What am I good at? What does the world need? And finally, what can the world afford? Right? So let me give you an example of that. I know a lot of people who adore and love their pets. Right? Yeah. Hands go up.
Folks,
hands go
right up. Here.
It's not me.
Yeah.
Okay. That's okay. I love to visit other people's pets, but it's not my love language to connect and interact with pets. Particularly, let's go with the dog, okay? So let's say that you love dogs and that you have a particular skill of connecting and caring for dogs. You know how to watch for their language. You know how to tell the difference between their bark for an alert and their bark for attention, right? So this is a skill that more than likely has been cultivated by being exposed to dogs, okay? Yep. So you can learn that skill, but if you don't have the interest, the love of dogs, you're not going to spend a lot of time learning that. I can't tell the difference, right? But I know that there is a skill there. So those who love dogs have a skill of being in relationship with dogs and enjoy that relationship. What does the world need? Hello.
Dog trainers.
Dog trainers. Dog sitters.
I was just going to say dog walkers.
Yes, because our lives are so full. So why would I want to not have a dog just because I work a 15-hour day with a commute that makes it difficult and inconsistent when I get home? I want my dog to have the best care. So I want to hire someone who loves dogs, is good with dogs, and I want to pay them to give my dog the care that I would give them if I could.
Right.
Right? So then, what's the financial exchange? If there is, right? My kid, she does dog sitting for free because I won't let her have a dog. So it's valuable for her to
she
go do dog sitting.
She
gets
to
be with a dog, gets to care for a dog, gets to cultivate her dog whispering skills, and yet I don't have to deal with the dog hair and my allergies at home. So what does that mean, right? When we get clear on these four lists, we might need someone to help us identify what is a skill versus a oh, but everyone can do that. Bullshit, right? That's the biggest hurdle we have is that, yeah, but we don't see our strengths because they come easy to us. Mm-hmm. In which case, we dilute their power. And so having an outside person, someone who is whether paid or you've got a really good connection that someone can give you feedback authentically, mm-hmm. right? Compassionately, but yet still directly. These are skills that I'm finding aren't being taught in our day-to-day living. They're really not. And so unless you have someone who is trained to do that, you could actually end up hurting your relationship as opposed to enhancing your relationship or discovering your life's work. Yes. So there's a time and a place to hire someone to do this work. Just like when it's time and a place to hire a dog sitter, there's a time and a place to hire a coach. And that person, in my opinion, in my life's work coaching, is about holding the position of witness until you're able to cultivate your own witness so that you can see your alignment, know your life's work. That doesn't mean you ever, quote, outgrow feedback or ever right. finish the journey.
God, I hope not, right?
It's a continual evolution. I hope. I mean, otherwise, well, I'm going to get bored. Right? I mean, I'm going to get bored because that's the bottom line for me is that I am not a maintenance person. I am a transformation facilitator.
Yeah. If someone was not yet ready for a coach, is there a book you absolutely love to help people break through themselves and their own limitations so that they can step out and begin to be present?
Anything by Brené Brown. She speaks in a way that although she is a well-educated professional woman, she speaks in a way that is so real, authentic. And she speaks about this vulnerability and the authenticity, and that's how we're going to change the world. It's important
work. She
makes
it possible for us to rumble and be able to be productive.
Yes, that's a great word. Rumble and renegade. They're friends, right? Because
they really are.
You can't be a renegade unless you're willing to rumble.
Amen.
But even more important than that is that to be a renegade is not to spit in the face of community. It's to say that I want authenticity. And the way that we reach authenticity is about rumbling through where my expectations, my thoughts, my questions, my vernacular may differ from yours. So stop trying to be someone else and be you. You are already fully equipped to become and to be, to embody the beautiful being that you are. And if I could have learned that,
I could have cut 10 years off my own journey.
Lots of extra 25 pounds of stress. but here's the thing. I am not interested in being in relationship with perfect people. I'm interested in being in relationship with authentic people. People who are fallible. Because that's where that rumble happens. Mm-hmm. But if we already are in alignment, this is where we get the yes culture of, oh yes, you're at this. No, I'm interested in the conversation. I'm not interested in having us agree all the time.
Thank you. I love you. I know everyone else is going to love you. And take a chance. Tell everybody where they can find you if they find themselves ready.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Lifesworkyoga.com. That's all one word. Life's with an apostrophe, but of course, you know, websites don't have an apostrophe, but Lifesworkyoga, all one word.com.
Thank you. So much.
What an honor, what a privilege to be able to share.